Okay, welcome everybody. On a rainy Sunday morning, but not sure who's listening, and it may be a Sunday evening, depending where you are on the planet. Okay, so we're going to continue going through the book, An Open-Hearted Life, which is also published in the UK and Australia under the title of Living with an Open Heart. But it's the same book. And so we're now on chapter 35. The nice thing about many of these chapters is that you can, you know, get them even though you haven't done all of the preceding things. So for people who are just coming in now, this chapter won't be any problem with understanding, because I think just being a human being gives us a good basis for understanding the four immeasurables, which are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Okay, so I always like to start with a little bit of silent meditation, even though you just did some meditation, so we can just kind of calm our mind, center our mind again, and then we'll cultivate our motivation and then have the talk. And then let's cultivate our motivation. And remember how intertwined our lives are with the lives of other living beings. How we are not independent entities who can manage and do everything ourselves, unless you know how to build and plant and plumb and put in electricity, and you're an expert in everything and can do everything alone. Unless that's the case, we're all dependent on other living beings. And let's remember, too, that we can't control everything in the world. But if we can manage our mind and tame the mental afflictions, if we can do that, or as we gradually do that, the happier we will become. So at the same time we tame our mental afflictions, we also want to put energy into cultivating the virtuous mental factors. And compassion is one of the big ones here. It's the wish that living beings be free of misery and its causes. And implied in compassion is a commitment to help bring them that about as much as we can. And so to really do our best to bring that about, let's generate the aspiration to attain full Buddhahood, where we will be free of all the impediments to benefiting others and have all of the good qualities to be able to do so. So generate that bodhicitta mind. And let's make this hour that we share together something really valuable in actually cultivating the bodhicitta. Four immeasurables. So based on the Buddha's teachings, the four immeasurables, love, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity, present a way to relate to other living beings that is healthy and brings happiness. This is very practical advice we're about to receive here on how to adjust our mind to make our interactions with all living beings something that is peaceful and beneficial. So these four qualities are called immeasurable because ideally we cultivate them towards all the immeasurable number of living beings, including animals and insects, and we cultivate them to an immeasurable or unbounded extent. Okay, so here's what these four are. Love wishes living beings to have happiness and its causes. Okay, that's what love is. That's not what you hear on the radio, what love is. But this is what love is from a Buddhist perspective. Compassion wishes living beings to be free from suffering and its causes. Empathic joy delights at the happiness and good fortune of others instead of being jealous of them. And equanimity is a balanced mind free from bias and personal distress. Okay. So all four are based on a deep understanding in our hearts that everyone wants happiness and does not want suffering. That's the basis to understand. And everyone is worthy of having happiness and freedom from suffering. So not only does everybody want happiness and freedom from suffering, but everybody, no matter who they are, no matter how they have acted and what they've done, they still deserve happiness and freedom from suffering. So this goes very much against one of our strong societal things, which is if people harm others, they should be punished and they should be made to suffer. And that somehow making somebody suffer will make them change. Okay. Now, when you were a kid and you were punished, you may have done what you were supposed to afterwards out of fear of more pain, but yeah, were you doing it voluntarily? Were you doing it with respect? Did the punishment itself change your mind? Or did the punishment make you fearful? Yeah, because if we're, you know, there's a big difference between doing what other people want us to do or what we're supposed to do because we really see the reason for it and fear of punishment if we don't. Yeah. So punishment often doesn't really bring the results we want. Because we may accord with what somebody wants when they're monitoring us. And as soon as they don't, then we go back to our home ways where we can get away with things. What we really want is actual change in the heart. Okay, as mentioned before, we generate this understanding that everybody wants happiness and freedom from suffering, and everybody deserves happiness and freedom from suffering. We generate that understanding by reflecting on it repeatedly in relation to each and every living being we encounter. So you might start with some of the people who it's easier to wish well to, and then go to strangers, and then go to some of the people that really make your blood boil. And remember that they're just trying to be happy and not suffer. Okay? And so wishing them happiness doesn't mean that we wish they get everything they want, because sometimes what they want is not good for them. But it could mean, if we wish them happiness, that whatever it is that's preventing them from having a sense of well-being is removed. Okay, so based on that understanding, love or loving kindness is the attitude we cultivate as our general way of relating to people. Okay, so this is kind of the basic MO, is loving kindness. So whenever we meet, see, or greet someone, we are friendly and wish them well. Yeah? So that's not really too much to ask, is it? Yeah? That we just smile at somebody and show a kind face. You know, you don't have to give away all your money. You don't have to do 15 backflips. You just smile and say hello. It makes a big difference, okay, to be friendly and wish somebody well. And yet, some people find that so difficult. Yeah? They're very stuck in their own pain, and they can't see beyond it. And that's quite sad. Yeah? But I read that in studies they've done, that if you smile, there's something about, I guess, moving the muscles or whatever. It activates some area in your brain that makes you feel happier. So if you smile, it's actually good for you and good for the other person. Yeah. And it really isn't too hard. Yeah. Not too hard. Yeah. Okay, so this is very different from being in a grumpy mood and seeing everyone as a pest who is in your way. Yeah? So if we cultivate an attitude of love, it's just, you know, we're open, we're kind, we're warm, we smile, you know? And we don't have to walk around. Yeah. Or walk around with our AR-15 strapped to our chest to protect us from all the harmful beings who we glower at. Okay? Or be grouchy. Yeah. And just complain. Yeah. Yeah, when somebody's grouchy, it doesn't matter the words they say, because what you pick up on is what I just did. Yeah? You don't even need the words. When we're grouchy, we can remember the kindness of others and how our lives depend on them, and then release the grouchiness in favor of loving kindness. Huh? My brother just sent me a little thing, which I forwarded to you, about wearing a mask. And one of the lines is, stop being so grouchy and listen to Fauci and wear a mask. Is that too much to ask? wear a mask. Be kind to yourself, be kind to other people. When we encounter people who are suffering, our response is compassion, so loving kindness when we first meet them. If they're unhappy or miserable, with compassion, and compassion is the wish to them to be free from whatever physical or mental pain they're experiencing, from a small annoyance to extreme agony. Okay, compassion enables us to look at suffering in all its forms without falling into despair and without being limited by our own personal distress. So personal distress is our mental attitude that doesn't like to see other people suffer because it makes us worried and in a bad mood and afraid and so forth. Yeah. So that personal distress is focused around my pain at seeing your pain, but it shifted the focus from really compassion for the other person who's the one who's suffering to wanting to eliminate anything that makes me uncomfortable, where it's focused on ourselves. Okay, so compassion also enables us to respond in an effort to alleviate that suffering. An active response is a hands-on approach where we actively engage in helping or in donating the resources, enabling somebody else to help. So it could range from, you know, when you're in a store and somebody has a screaming child, to distract the child, you know, make faces and, you know, wave to them and something. You know, it's a small action that really helps a mom, yeah, or a dad. Or it could be donating, like yesterday we had the fundraiser for Buddhist Global Relief. So really, you know, sharing our wealth with others who lack food and supporting education for girls. Those are the two of the things that they specialize in. Okay. The taking and giving meditation is an indirect response. Okay, the others were direct because we're really dealing with the person who's suffering. But an indirect response is that meditation where we imagine taking on the suffering of others and giving them our happiness, whereby our heart is open and engaged, although we are not able to actively do a specific task to help the other at that time. So there's many situations in which we see somebody suffering and we want to do something and we're not there or we don't have the skill or whatever it is. So this meditation is very effective to do because it keeps us involved in a loving and compassionate way with the other person. Instead of just saying, well, there's nothing I can do, so I'll go have a hot fudge sundae instead. Okay. Keeps us involved in a proper way. When seeing others experience good fortune or engage in virtuous activities, the third of the four measurables, empathic joy, is our response. So instead of making ourselves miserable by being jealous of another's success, we open our heart and share their happiness with them. Yeah. And it's certainly a lot more pleasant than being jealous. Jealous. I don't know about you, but for me, it is one of the most painful mental states to be horrifically jealous of somebody, you know, and resentful. They don't deserve that happiness. I do. You know, it's so painful. So empathic joy that rejoices at others' happiness and well-being and opportunity is a good remedy for that. By rejoicing in others' good qualities and successes, empathic joy enables us to see goodness in the world. Yeah? Whereas jealousy, we don't see goodness. We want to destroy others' goodness because we think we deserve it more. But rejoicing really emphasizes to ourselves the goodness in the world. Rejoicing also makes our mind receptive to generating the good qualities we rejoice in seeing in others. Yeah, so the more we rejoice in what we see in others, the more we feel inspired to generate those same good qualities. Okay, then the fourth one, equanimity, which is impartial, open-hearted concern for all beings, is our response in two situations. Okay, so one situation is when the other person is doing well and doesn't need our help. Okay, so your child grew up, you know, is grown, they can manage their own life. You don't need to be a helicopter parent and worry about them anymore. Right? Good. Yeah. So, you know, we have empathy and or equanimity and some rejoicing at their happiness, but we're equanimous in the sense that they're doing well. We don't need to interfere, okay? So here we refrain from interfering in others' lives by giving advice that is both unasked for and unnecessary because they are already doing well. But actually, if they followed my advice, they could do even better than they're already doing. Yeah, and they aren't really doing that well because, you know, I said to approach it going this way and they went this way. So they should really go back and approach the whole situation. You know, okay, it's getting the same result, but according to the way I think it should be done, because my way is the best and kindest and most compassionate and wisest way. And I'm going to control you, by the way, or try to, until you tell me to get lost, which you will eventually. And I may not follow your instructions. Okay. So, giving unasked for advice, it is so tempting, isn't it? It is so tempting because we really know how other people should think and behave. But unless somebody's asked you to, you know, give them advice, even when they don't ask, then it's better, you know, not to give direct advice or to leave little hints. Yeah, like wash the dishes in big letters. Yeah, or one of my friends, her sister was not Buddhist, and she wanted her sister to, you know, become, at least read something. Well, the sister wasn't too keen on it. But what my friend did, and she didn't do this deliberately, but she was reading some Buddhist books and just left them around the house, you know, and her sister wound up picking them up and reading and going, oh, this is good. Okay. So that, you know, was a much smoother thing than going up and saying, well, you know, sis, you know, you really should read this book, which then the sister undoubtedly would not have read. Okay, in other words, giving people credit for their ability to manage their own affairs, we calm our need to be needed and let others be. Okay. So sometimes we need to be needed. Yeah. And we want to know what's going on with everybody. Yeah, what are you feeling? What's happening with you? Because then we feel in the know, and then we feel needed. You know, they need somebody to confide in. And I'm the chosen one. Yeah, but maybe they don't feel like talking about that, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. And we have to sometimes restrain our wish to ask questions, to fish out information about a situation that we suspect, but they're not telling us. Yeah, we have to really chill that out a little bit, you know? And, you know, you can tell when somebody really needs to talk, and they may need some prompting with questions, but you can also tell where somebody really doesn't feel comfortable talking right now, and it's better to leave them be. So there's one question where, you know, about somebody, how somebody else is doing, you know, when we question them. And then there's another thing where we want the latest gossip about what's going on. And so we push somebody who we think has more information than we do to tell us all the juicy things that we haven't heard yet. Yeah. But maybe that person doesn't feel comfortable talking about that. And maybe what they heard was in confidence. So our, you know, asking this question to get something out of them may not be well received, may make them quite uncomfortable. Okay, so calm our need to be needed. But the whole world needs me because they can't really manage their own lives very well, you know. And I'm quite good at giving advice and support and direction and everything. Yeah. Okay, so that's one situation which we need equanimity. And the second situation in which equanimity is desired in response is when somebody is facing difficulties, we try to help, but they rebuff our aid. They do not want our help. I'm only trying to help you. You're in a big jam, and I'm trying to help, and why are you pushing me away? You know, it's like you don't care about me at all, and I'm just trying to help you. You're so lost and can't manage your life very well anyway. Yeah. Okay. So in this case, rather than chiding the other person or pushing them to do something that they are clearly resistant to doing, we step aside. Yeah. It is really difficult sometimes when you see people making dumb decisions that they think are smart, and when you mention it to them, they get really defensive and mad at you. And the fact that you're suggesting it is one point for them in favor of not doing it or not considering it, because they're thinking, I will not be told what to do. I know what is best for me. And I don't care if you're an expert in this field. This is what I know is best for me. So just shut up. Okay, you ever had somebody tell you that when you were trying to help? Well, I know none of you ever act like. We don't really need to practice equanimity because nobody else in the community ever acts defensive in that way, do we? We are so open and resilient. Yeah? We never get defensive. Even if, you know, somebody says, oh, it might be good to add a little bit more detergent to the soapy water for the dishes. Look, I've been washing dishes since I was 7 years old. I know how to do it. Get off my case. Yeah, but nobody here gets defensive like that about big things or about little things. Extremely cooperative community. Except don't tell so-and-so to do this and don't tell the other one to do that. Because they all have their things that make them explode with a very short fuse. I won't give any examples right now. I value my life. Okay. So we step aside. For example, if our elderly parents want to remain at home when we think it would be safer at an assisted living facility, we need to realize that they are willing to risk taking a fall in return for the benefit of living in the familiar, comfortable, and comforting environment of their home. We have to honor their priorities and decisions, even though we know that those priorities and decisions are so wrong. Parents, what are we going to do with them? Oops. Okay, so there's things we just have to accept. Yeah. A similar situation may happen with parents whose children are young adults. As parents, your responsibility was to care for your children and teach them life skills, including how to manage different situations, to remain safe, and to make good decisions. However, when they are older, they do not need so much direct care and often resent their parents' well-meaning advice, which they perceive as meddling in their life and restricting their autonomy. At these times, parents need to recognize that they cannot control their children's behavior to make sure they are always safe, but must trust their children to make good decisions based on what they as parents taught them when they were younger. Okay, so the time to teach them is when they're young. Yeah, don't protect them so much by not explaining things and just making decisions for them. Explain why you make decisions. Teach them what kind of factors to examine when making a decision. If you do that when they're young, then they know how to make good decisions and how to be safe when they're older. If the young adults make bad decisions, parents need to accept that sometimes their children will learn only by making mistakes, the same way they learned from their own errors. Okay, did all of us do stupid things and learn from them? If when our parents told us not to do those things, did we want their advice? No. We did the things anyway, didn't we? And we learned from our experience, better not to do those things. I bet we could tell some really good stories. We did this one time at DFF, talking about some of the naughty things we did when we were kids. And one person described on Sunday morning, you know, they would play making breakfast while their parents were asleep. So they took out newspaper and made like little pieces of toast, you know, bread on the newspaper and put it in the toaster. Yeah, I think that one was the one that I remember the most. Somebody told. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Another thing could be drinking Clorox when you feel sick. Yeah, that one you may not live to show that you learned your lesson. Okay, so please don't drink Clorox. Okay, similarly, when a friend doesn't seem to learn from their mistakes, we also need to maintain equanimity, knowing that people create their own experiences through their actions and decisions, and that we cannot control them. Okay? So this kind of situation, it can be so frustrating. If you have a family member, let's say, who has a substance abuse problem, and you're trying to get them to AA or into detox or into some kind of help because you know they're really going downhill and their family relationships are a mess and they're on the verge of losing their job and so forth, and you try and talk to them and they get so angry and resentful, or they say, yes, yes, I'll do that, and then they don't do it. And then it's so difficult for the friends and family who really care about that person and don't want to see them go downhill. But there's really nothing that you can do. Yeah? Unless you want to lasso them and drag them somewhere. Yeah, which they may just run away from as soon as you let the lasso off. It's a difficult situation. Although I did know one family whose daughter, teenage daughter, was really going in a really bad direction. And they arranged an intervention of sorts where the treatment program came to the house and they convinced her to go, not by telling her that it was a treatment program, but by saying something else. But it got her to the treatment program and that helped her. But, you know, she was like 14 at the time, so really needed a big push, you know. If somebody's 25, that's much harder to do. Yeah. Our task at that time is to have a peaceful heart, free from guilt or self-blame, and to be open to help the other person should they request help in the future. So rather than get so mad that we just say, get out of here, I don't want to talk to you again, you know, have a loving attitude towards them, step back. Don't feel guilty because you can't help them. You tried, you did your best, okay? But don't be mad at them and instead maintain an open attitude, because later on, you know, they may realize that they need some help and they may come for help at that time, okay? Or they may get help in some other way, and after they've healed, then they may come back and want to reestablish the relationship. Yeah, so don't ever say, this person is so toxic, I need them out of my life completely. They can't even walk on the street where I want to see them. You know, that attitude's a bit extreme. We may not like somebody or we may disapprove of them, but we can always be polite, can't we? Yeah. I don't think being polite and being respectful at just as we would from one human being to the next, I don't think that shows that you necessarily favor what that person's doing. Yeah. It's just normal human manners. At least what I think. Yeah? Instead of like, Yeah. Because if you're like that, what's in your heart? Your whole heart is tied up in anger and hatred and resentment and fear. And you may keep that person out of your life, but your heart is like this, you know, out of fear. So I think it's better to realize, yeah, you can not be close to somebody. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah, but you can be polite if you see them. You don't need to be close and talk for a long time, but you can say hello. Each of the four immeasurables has a close enemy, which appears to be that quality, but is a distortion of it. And each of the four immeasurables also has a far enemy, which is the opposite of it and needs to be counteracted. Okay? So this is really shows how our mind can be very tricky. So the close enemy of love, okay, the enemy that appears to be that quality but isn't, is clinging attachment or possessive love for another person. Yeah? It's pretending, oh, I care so much about you and you're so wonderful and you're so dear, but it's like, you know? Okay. So this emotion appears to be love, in that it is attracted to another person, but clinging and self-centeredness corrupt it. We remedy this by reflecting that it is our mind that has exaggerated that person's good qualities or projected good qualities that aren't there, and then clung to that person, mistakenly thinking that they are the objective source of our happiness. Okay, so this also stems from not being aware of our own emotional needs and finding a healthy way to meet them, or a healthy way in our meditation to release those emotional needs. Okay, but looking outside and thinking somebody else will do that. Ill will and hatred are the far enemies of love, the opposite of love, and they are counteracted by cultivating patience and fortitude, and by wishing others to have happiness in its causes. Okay, then we'll move on to anger. Personal distress and exaggerated grief are the close enemies of compassion. We may mistakenly believe that unless we are overwhelmed with grief or despair when witnessing another's suffering, that we don't really care for or have compassion for them. Yeah? And so some people are really, you know, it's hard for them to be in touch with their emotions and to really figure out what they're feeling. But maybe sometime in their upbringing, they got the message that in order to show that you really care for somebody, you know, when some small thing happens to them, you have to be so upset and you have to, you know, despair and jump in and try and do something, because that's how you show that you're compassionate. Okay. But that can that kind of personal distress that we have actually becomes a problem for the other person who is suffering, because then they not only have to manage their own suffering, but they have to help us because we're so upset about them suffering. Okay? So it is neither necessary nor beneficial to become personally distressed when witnessing others suffering, because such feelings interfere with our ability to reach out and help them. Instead, we need to cultivate genuine compassion that is focused on the other's suffering. Okay, so I remember a good example of this was when I was in Singapore, and one family called me to come and talk because one of their relatives was dying. So I came in the home, and I expected to go in right away and talk to the person who was dying, who was in a bedroom. Well, that wasn't the plan of the family. They kept me in the living room for a half an hour or more talking because they were so distressed about the relative dying. But they weren't the people who were dying, you know, and they wanted their relative to have a peaceful death, but their, you know, personal distress prevented me from having more time with the person who was actually dying, who needed the time, okay? Okay, and then cruelty, the wish to inflict suffering on others, is the far enemy of compassion. It's the opposite of compassion. The antidote to it is compassion itself and the determination to release our resentment, grudges, and desire for revenge. And I know for me, what works really well, if I see some desire for revenge coming up, even if it's a small thing, you know, I can make one small little comment that will get to somebody, is to stop and say, do I respect myself if I deliberately cause others pain? And the answer is clearly no. Yeah. Do I want to be that kind of person? No. So then it becomes much easier to leave aside the wish for revenge. And revenge can be very subtle. It doesn't have to be the gross one of lock her up, you know, that they were chanting last night in Michigan, to which he replied, lock them up. Yeah, it doesn't have to be that. It can just be something more subtle, but we don't want to be that kind of person. Okay, so the close enemy of empathic joy is giddiness and excitement, a mind that is too high and full of unrealistic expectations when seeing others' success. Yeah. So my child, you know, graduated with, you know, near perfect score, and now I'm sure they will go to Ivy League. You know, they will get a job at a famous company. Soon they will be on the Supreme Court, or they'll be on this somebody else who the Supreme Court is trying a case against, you know, because they're so intelligent and they knew how to finagle this and that and the other thing. So now there's a court case for against them. But no, I'm not rejoicing at that. But do you see the whole thing about empathic joy is we're too happy, yeah? And then that adds tons of expectations onto the other person that they feel that they have to meet. Yeah. My child, they'll be a genius. They will be picked out for every single thing. And the kid's just going, will you let me be? Okay. Then, okay. So we free ourselves from this giddiness and expectations by calming our mind and using the reflection of mindful checking in, which is in entry number 9 in the book. Jealousy and boredom are the distant enemies of empathic joy. Jealousy destroys our internal well-being by making us unable to bear the happiness of others. Oh, I just can't endure it. Oh, okay, that's so painful. Jealousy motivates us to act in ways that destroy others' happiness, which in turn we usually feel terrible about doing afterwards. Okay. For example, we may be jealous that our friend can afford a new car and hope that it gets dented or breaks down. Okay? The antidote to jealousy is rejoicing in others' success and in their good qualities. After all, we often say, may all beings have happiness and its causes, and here someone has those, and we didn't even have to lift a finger to make it happy. So why not rejoice? Boredom, which is also the opposite of empathic joy, is a withdrawn mind that doesn't care enough to rejoice at what is good and worthwhile. Oh, you completed 100,000 prostrations. Congratulations. Okay. Oh, yeah, you helped that charity. I'm really glad. Okay. So, yeah, boredom doesn't care enough. We don't care enough to rejoice at what is good and worthwhile. And we can remedy that by getting some exercise and by thinking about things that interest us. That will make the mind a little bit more buoyant. Yes, right. I did one, rejoice. Indifference, apathy, and uncaring are the close enemies of equanimity. We have to be especially careful not to slide into these by misunderstanding the meaning of equanimity and instead closing our hearts. Okay? So equanimity is an open-hearted care and concern felt equally towards all beings without being biased towards one person and against another. So when I said this to one Tibetan Geshe, he said, empathy or equanimity isn't the open-hearted care and concern. That's what you develop when you develop love. Okay? But, you know, implying that equanimity is just a flat baseline thing. But for me, you know, unless I have some kind of care and concern, I don't have equanimity, I have indifference. Yeah. So I think it's, you know, what we want to have, a care and concern. It doesn't have to be obsessive. It's just, you know, this is a human being and they're worthy of respect. And, you know, like that. Okay. Attachment, anger, and partiality are the far enemies of equanimity. So we hear these in the Bhikshuni precepts. Yeah, when somebody accuses the Sangha of, you know, being having partiality, hate, what is it? Partiality, hatred, fear, and ignorance. Okay. And we're highly discouraged from accusing the Sangha and individuals from putting that, blaming them for that. Attachment, anger, and partiality are the far enemies of equanimity. Okay? So instead of just having an equal mind, we're very reactive. We cling to the person, we push them away. The way to cultivate equanimity was described in entry 22. So go back and read that. By consciously cultivating the four immeasurables, we will respond to others more gently and more realistically. Love, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity will enable us to have better relationships with others. You may wish to remind yourself of these four immeasurable qualities by reciting in the morning and at any other time you wish the following verse. And this is a verse that when people write to me and they say, I just need something simple to practice, really simple, I give them this verse. Okay? So to just recite and recite and contemplate and bring into your heart. May all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. That's love. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. That's compassion. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. That's empathic joy. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So that's equanimity. Okay? Then the reflection to do on the four immeasurables. So this is your homework assignment. Slowly reflect on each of the four immeasurables one by one. At the end of these four reflections, let your mind rest in the feelings of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Okay? So when you reflect on these, it isn't like if you reflect on compassion, you say, compassion, compassion, compassion. That's not the meaning of it. To reflect on compassion, you think of others' kindness to you so that you have an attitude of care and concern for them, and then you reflect on their misery. Okay? And those two things together will bring compassion. That's how to cultivate compassion. Okay? So with each of these, you know, it isn't just saying the name to yourself. And it's not saying, I should feel empathic joy. I should rejoice when somebody got this benefit and I didn't. No, that's not how you generate it. It's by really, you know, looking at the other person and saying, you know, look, somebody has some joy. And there's, you know, some days there's not a lot of joy in this world. And here is somebody who had some good things, or they did some really wonderful, virtuous actions that are beyond my ability to do. And I'm just happy that they have that talent. I'm happy that they did that activity. Yeah. Okay, and then the second point is contemplate specific relationships or situations in your life where having one of these four in your mind would be especially helpful. Okay, so maybe there's somebody who really pushes your buttons, and consciously cultivating one of these four will help you get rid of your button. And when we get rid of our buttons, then everybody can go like this, but they can't push them. Imagine having that quality when you relate to that individual or are in that situation. Yeah? So just imagine, instead of being fearful or whatever, that you have confidence in your own ability to act in a constructive way and to make good decisions in the situation. Okay? And then the third point in the reflection, consider the close enemies of each of the four and notice if you have the tendency to slide into any of them. If so, remind yourself of the meaning of that quality. Okay? So we have time for a couple of questions.
I have yet to endeavor to do this, but to be able to have one of these as an object of meditative stabilization to cultivate, samadhi or concentration, to be able to just look at examples like this and just do it so repeatedly to get the flavor in the mind that deepens and gets stronger? How would the process? I always get a little superficial about it. I don't really.
Yeah, you have to, you know, go over the different steps, let's say, to generate that particular quality. And then you develop your concentration after you you know, you have the feeling of that quality in your heart, then you, your concentration is just on that feeling and on spreading it to all others. So it's not just a feeling of love here in my heart where I feel good, but where you feel completely open and you are spreading friendliness and goodwill and respect to all living beings. You know, your mental attitude is one of doing that.
Tracia would then make that whole process be a spontaneous, easy kind of just drop into it with the thought?
Yeah. I mean, the more you're familiar, you know, the more you do the meditation on one of these, then even in your daily life, the easier it is to feel that. So definitely when you're sitting in meditation, that feeling can come up more easily, you know, easier. If it doesn't, then you go through the steps of generating it. Mm-hmm. But for sure, at the beginning, you're going to have to go through the steps of generating it a lot. Yeah.
I've always just loved the concept of being able to use one of these as an object of serenity. I think it's just wonderful aspiration.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
I wanted to clarify the definition of equanimity. Because I get confused when, like, you know, in the dictionary, like Jeffrey Hopkins, the definition includes indifference and neutral feeling and neglect. Does equanimity have shades of meaning depending on the context?
There's different kinds of equanimity in Buddhism, but none of them involve indifference or neglect. Or anything like that. Yeah. There's the kind of equanimity when you're developing concentration where you have already, you know, maybe you had an interference to your concentration and you applied an antidote already. And then after that, you have equanimity in not repeatedly applying the antidote once you've solved the problem. Okay. Another kind of equanimity is the feeling and the feeling aggregate of equanimity. So that is one that is without attachment, without, you know, hatred, without partiality. It's just an equal feeling, you know? And then the other is the equanimity that is one of the immeasurables. And then there's several more forms of equanimity too. If you look in Praise of Great Compassion under equanimity, and I think it's in chapter one, it may say there or somewhere else in the book about the different kinds of equanimity.
So something that confuses me a little bit on the verse of the four immeasurables is that mm-hmm. the first two feels like I'm having love by wishing others to have happiness and I'm having compassion by wishing others to be free of suffering.
Yeah.
But then the fourth one, it feels like I'm wishing others to have equanimity.
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit? It feels like it switches there.
Yes, it does. And I had that same reaction. So there's two ways of doing the four immeasurables. There's the way I just described. And there you can see that the reason for that sequence is, you know, your first way of dealing with people is love. And then if they're unhappy, compassion and so on, you know? So there you can see that sequence. When they put equanimity first, then what you're doing is like a preparation for the meditation on the 7-point instruction on developing bodhicitta, because there you put equanimity first. But that still doesn't answer the question of why it's wishing for others to have equanimity when in the 7-point instruction, it's developing equanimity ourselves towards everybody. And the only way I can think of it, you know, I'm sure there's a better explanation, I just don't know it, but is that, you know, if you really want to cultivate the other ones, we have to have equanimity. Yeah. I mean, you really can't cultivate the other three unless we have equanimity. So it should really, you know, if I'm going to wish others to have it, I need to develop it too. And actually, the verse does say, may all sentient beings, and we are a sentient being, we're one of them. So, you know, we can start with ourselves.
Well, I ordained as a lay person, I was in a relationship, and then my mind was turning, and I knew that I could not develop equanimity in that context. So, yeah, still, I'm convinced I wouldn't be able to do that. What advice do you give to lay people who have a close relationship, who have a family and all that? Because there's a speciality, you know, you think about these close ones probably more than anybody else. And even we as monastic have certainly favorites among each other. And, you know, to balance that out, can you give a little bit more of a practical advice?
Okay. So we have to remember that all these questions, it's not either you have no equanimity or you have lots of equanimity. Okay. It's a good quality to develop whether you are a lay person or a monastic. And you start out where most of us have very little equanimity, and you just practice the best you can to increase it. And that's the method for doing it. Doesn't matter, lay, monastic, or whatever. Yeah.